I do most of the cooking in my house. And the way that this generally works is my partner will send me a recipe which he found on a website or an app as a screenshot in WhatsApp. And then I will cook with my phone on the worktop with her WhatsApp message open and the image open, and my phone will go to sleep and I'll have to unlock it with messy hands, or someone else will message me and something will happen on my phone. And this was an altogether unsatisfying way to cook. And of course, we've got cookbooks as well that we sometimes use. But I also find cookbooks unsatisfying because they're big and unwieldy and take up a lot of room in the kitchen, which could be used for, you know, cooking in.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is the solution to this educating your partner on how to send URLs to you in, or is that not good enough because you still have to keep unlocking your phone?
Exactly. So then I've still got the problem of, you know, scrolling through a million pages of their the chef's life story before I actually find the recipe, and then, yeah, all sorts of stuff. And then they want me to subscribe to their newsletter. Anyway, so I needed a better way of reading recipes while I'm cooking. So naturally, I thought, right, what I need to do is make some sort of web app with a database, and then I can put all of my recipes in a database, and then I need some sort of online terminal in the kitchen which can connect to my server, and I can search the recipes and find what I'm cooking that day.
Yep, so a term I heard at Og Camp is an overuse of your profession.
Exactly. So then I thought about it a bit more, and I thought, no, wait a minute. Recipes aren't data. Recipes are information. What I need to be able to do with a recipe is read it with my eyes and nothing else.
Did you just print it?
I didn't just print it, because I also have a recipe keeper, and that's big and fat and unwieldy, and the bits of paper get crumpled up and whatever, and holes torn in them, and they fall out of the bindings. So,
sorry, please, sir, you said a recipe keeper. What is a recipe keeper?
No, a recipe keeper is basically a binder with recipe cards in.
Oh. Okay.
But it's, you know, it's about the size of a cookbook, which, you know, is the problem.
I appreciate, so, I'm sounding like I'm a complete novice at this, but I also do all the cooking in this house. Mm-hmm. It's just you're using terms and ways of working that are just alien to me. So, yeah, tell us your new way of doing things.
So what I thought is, why don't I just get a secondhand e-reader and load my recipes onto that, and that'll be nice and slim, and that can just live in the kitchen as the cookbook. Doesn't take up a lot of room,
and because it's e-ink, it stays on, right?
Exactly, it stays on, doesn't keep going to sleep, doesn't need charging all that often. All it needs to do is sit there and just display a page for a while, which e-ink is very good at doing. So I went onto eBay and I bought a Kobo Libra Color 2, maybe.
Okay.
Because that is the one that was for sale. And I quite like Kobos because they're nice, fairly open devices. You can just plug them in and sling stuff onto them. And I thought, well, all I need now is a way of taking these screenshots that my partner sent me on WhatsApp and getting them into some sort of format that can display easily on the Kobo. So I found an app in, I can't remember if it's a Snap or if it's just a Deb, that in Ubuntu's app installer, whatever it's called these days, called Frog, which is an OCR app that you can just copy and paste images into and it will find the text and show it to you.
That sounds quite useful.
Yeah, both of us went silent there. I'd never heard of this. And
no, like, nor had I. I searched for something like OCR or OCR on Ubuntu. And yeah, there it was. You can either take an image with your webcam or open an image, or if you've got an image on your clipboard, you just click paste image and it gives you the text. It's very good. It doesn't do anything else, just that. Perfect. So with the text in hand, I then just wanted to format it fairly nicely. So I found a plugin for Joplin, my note-taking app of choice, called Recipe Scaler, which has basically a simple format for creating a recipe card, and then you just write your recipe as markdown underneath it. And from there, I could just say export as PDF and sling it on the Kobo.
Brilliant.
So yesterday evening, I spent going through my WhatsApp history and converting all of these recipes broken up over several images into nice PDFs, which I've now got.
What you need now is a web app where you can sling all of the screenshots at it and have it automatically make your recipe cards for you.
No, I think I like it this way. And the other thing, of course, is if I have another recipe, like a recipe I've written or a recipe that's in a cookbook, is I can just type it out as markdown and do exactly the same thing.
Yeah, or like copy and paste it off the web page or something like that. If it's
if it's already as text, that's helpful. But yeah, a lot of these things come from like apps where you subscribe to a set of recipe cards and you can only access them in the app, and it's not on my phone, so that's not as easy. But yeah, if it is just in text already, then copy and paste, hooray, result. I like this quite a lot, and I'm going to enjoy cooking a lot more now.
Yeah.
Does the Kobo have physical buttons for page forward and page backwards if it's like a multi-page recipe? Or is it like one where you actually hammer the screen, in which case if you've got dirty fingers, like how do you manage that?
So this one does, it's got a touch screen, but it does have, it's got a sort of, I'm going to show it to you on webcam, it's got a sort of a thicker bezel on one side to hold it in your hand, and then it has an up and down button on the side there, so you can page turn with physical buttons as well.
I might have to look into this because I have a Kobo Color, maybe a newer edition, as my ebook reader. But when I'm not on holiday reading books, it doesn't actually do a whole lot. So actually being my kitchen companion would breathe a whole new lease of life into it.
The other thing I discovered is that there's various bits of custom software that you can load on. It seems it's fairly easy. You just sort of drop a zip file in a particular directory and it will then load that on next time it reboots. So in a future episode, you may hear more about my adventures with homebrew Kobo software.
Brilliant.
Back in episode 72, I talked about a vibe coding contest that I entered where I couldn't possibly win because my boss was one of the judges. And the project that I created in round one of this contest was, I called Moji Nav, which is a walking navigation app designed to only show a user interface that uses emojis. No words, no letters or anything like that. It's just a picture of a beer glass. You press the beer glass, shows you all the places that sell beer. You tap on one of the places that sell beer and you get walking navigation to the place that sells beer. That's, you know, but it's not just beer. There are other things available as well, other amenities that it can find. And I put the source code on GitHub when I entered this contest, but then I kept iterating on the code live in production and then never committed, because I got into the habit of leaving the GitHub repo alone because it was like saved in aspic for the contest. I mean, right. I could have created a branch and just said, like, you know, the continuing adventures of Emoji Nav or whatever, and continued it in a branch and then merged it after the contest finished, but for some reason my brain wouldn't let me do that. So I was just SSH'd into my server because it was just a stupid app. I didn't really care. And I was doing loads of Ninja edits in production. And last week I decided, well, I should probably clean this up and actually put it in a Git repo in a maintainable way and try and secure it and make sure some of the bugs that I've noticed or that people have mentioned to me in passing, or when I've tried to show it to someone and it broke, I've gone, oh, I should fix that. Those things I should probably fix.
What were the most egregious bugs that you had encountered in its 3 or 4 month lifetime?
The most egregious ones are based around it not working. So pressing the beer button and getting not an error message, but just an emoji. And you've got to try and interpret what that emoji means, right? Now the contest is finished, I feel that I am at liberty to create documentation that does not only consist of emojis. And so I've created an about page, which I think is helpful because it explains what the error emojis mean. And also explains how you use it and what the various emojis map to, like, one is parking, one is a park, one is a gym, that kind of thing. And so what those actually mean is the answer. Right. but not actually working was a big one, because that actually led to a few code changes and probably might lead to some more maintenance in the future, because I'm using free APIs, and sometimes those APIs related to mapping, finding immunities, doing route planning, using the free versions, they're usually heavily rate limited. And so you can make a request and they just fail. And so that was one problem, is there is a problem in that the various free services, unsurprisingly, are not like five nines with infinite capacity for some freeloader like myself using them. So that was one. That was one of them. Is it just not working? And there was another one I found along the way there, which is one of the APIs I use is called Overpass, and something they introduced, I don't know, at some point in the last 3 or 4 months, is that you must specify a user agent so they can track you down and, like, you know, or block you or whatever. Mm-hmm. And because I was just using some, you know, library, whatever, Python library to do the HTTP request, I didn't specify a user agent. And that solved that. That was just like, okay, I understand what I should be doing right here. And so I specified a user agent, and that solved that one. So there's two main problems were availability of the service and me not complying with the API.
And what does Overpass do?
So there's a couple of APIs I need. One of them is there's actually three services I use. One of them is to find amenities near me. And the other one is to do the route planning from where I am now to wherever that is. Mm-hmm. And the third one is to show the map tiles. And the map tiles is a thing called Stadia. And the other two are to do the amenity location. And those are the ones that are really rate limited, the amenity location. And so if I say find pubs, it can just error immediately. And I'll just have to back off and try again later, because there's only like a very small amount of requests that the service will accept at any point in time, not just from me, but from anyone. Mm. There's like two listeners or something. It's really, really low. Some of the other things I added, the map now rotates. I know. Like previously, the way I implemented it is the map just stays, north is up. And right. So when you're walking...
You've got to rotate yourself.
Well, I mean, you can see the little pin as you're walking, the little pin moves around the map. And so, you know, it's not intuitive, because every other mapping application, you know, it rotates to the direction. And so I added that quite recently and then walked out the back garden and walked down the road to see if it works. And sure enough, it does rotate. It's not smooth. There could be some easing functions in there that make it a little bit nicer, but it just, like, you know, keeps you pointing in the right direction on the screen, is in front of you, that kind of thing. So little things like that were, you know, quality of life improvements for the user. Not that there are any users of this thing. There's also a welcome screen now. So previously, if you went to mojinav.pobi.com, which is the URL it's at, the first thing it would do is ask for your location. Now, that's because it's a navigation app, and it's completely useless without knowing your location, because it doesn't know where to search around for amenities, but it doesn't tell you that. And it can't tell you that because you're not allowed to put any words on the screen. And so the initial implementation didn't give you the assistance to say, hey, I'm going to ask for your location now so that we can find things near you. I've now added that welcome screen, and it now shows that first and then shows you a little thing underneath telling you, like, we're not going to log your location, and your location will be sent to these providers. So they might, because that's where we're sending it to get the amenities and the route planning. And then you just press the button and it does the normal, this website would like to know your location, allow or not. So that was a little quality of life improvement as well. And that was mostly the big things that really jumped out at me that had to do. There was loads of like underlying it, like library updates and some silly things that had been coded incorrectly. Because remember, this was a one-shot vibe-coded application. I wrote a 13-kilobyte text file, fed it to an AI, and in one shot, this application came out, right? It was a one-shot prompt, which I was quite proud of at the time because it got a working application out of a 13-kilobyte text file. Go back to episode 72 to hear more about that. For round two, it was a 20-kilobyte one-shot prompt. So I felt it was perfectly reasonable for there to be loads of weirdnesses and errors and stuff in here because it was just vibe coded. I didn't even look at the code when it was generated. And the one other big thing I wanted to do, I don't like the fact that I'm running it in Docker. See previous episodes. I don't really like that I'm running it in Docker on my server. I'd kind of rather like to put this where most of my other stuff is in Cloudflare. I just find that a lot easier to deal with because I can just land stuff in main and push it and it will find its way onto Cloudflare. But there are some architectural decisions I made when I've hybrided this that mean that's a bit harder. So I might have to either rewrite or re-implement stuff or maybe split it and have the front end in Cloudflare and the back end somewhere else. I'm not sure.
If you were to re-implement this or re-engineer it in some way so that you could run it in Cloudflare, would that open up the possibility to sort of self-host things like the Overpass APIs and the other things that are rate limited?
Yes. Uh-huh. And that's one of the things yes and no, because some of that stuff is quite computationally heavy. And so I might actually self-host those things. So the front end of my application in Cloudflare, re-implement the back end, put it in Cloudflare as a worker. And then for the third party APIs, maybe because there a couple of them are open source and I can just build them myself, but they require you to take a giant data set and then build the list of amenities and cache them somewhere. And that's some level of computation. Now, those amenities don't change that regularly. You know, swimming pools don't get built every other day. And while pubs do close at a very sad rate of knots in the UK, they're not, yeah, it's not that much. So I could update that data periodically, but not like every, you know, hour or anything like that. So yeah, there's still some stuff to do. And I realize there's no users for this thing. It's a fun little exercise and it's more an exercise for myself to see what would a vibe-coded app look like if you turned it into something half decent, as in, you know, you made it more secure, you made it more updatable, more reliable, you know, not rely on free APIs that are slow or unreliable, and see where we go from there. There might be further episodes in this story, and if, you know, people have questions or question my sanity, feel free to send us an email because I'm questioning it as well. But it's quite a fun little thing because it's quite tightly scoped. It's not got a lot of, you know, chance for feature creep with this. It's a navigation app. It absolutely does have opportunity for that, you know, sponsored venues and like driving, and it could go a bit crazy, but I'm going to try and keep it to exactly the scope that it has originally.
Okay.
I just make it more reliable and make it easier to maintain and make it properly open source. So the one that's published is the one that's actually out there, you know, live. Also, the vibe coded version said that it was MIT licensed and there was no license file in the repository. I didn't bother putting that in there. So, you know, little things like that to, you know, fix my license compliance and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, maybe you'll hear more about this in the future.
Last year, Framework released their first desktop computer, and I looked at that and I thought, ooh, this is very interesting. I think I might want one of those. But then I discovered they hadn't built it properly. So there was only one solution, which is if a job's worth doing, you do it yourself. So I have built myself a DIY Framework desktop.
By properly, what's the thing that's not proper?
So there was two things. The actual main board of the Framework desktop is excellent. And when I saw, so this is a Ryzen AI Max Plus 395 based main board, which is a system on chip, which is a high-end Ryzen processor and integrated IGP and neural processors and all sorts of stuff. And the RAM is also on the SoC. And you can get laptops with this chipset on it, and you can get small mainboards with this chipset on it. And one of the features is it has a PCI slot, and the framework desktop, the case that they have, doesn't allow you to access the PCI slot.
Right. So that was going to be my question, because I was thinking that what you were doing was taking a framework laptop mainboard and building a desktop computer from it. But the framework desktop doesn't use the same mainboard, does it? And I wasn't aware that that had a PCI slot,
right,
which saves me from my next question.
Yeah, so the first thing is I wanted to use that PCI slot. It's only a 4-lane PCI slot, but we'll get into why that was perfect for what I needed to use. And the other thing that the framework desktop does wrong is it has Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, and I didn't want that. But what I did want to use is the PCI slot, or the weird port. It's an NGFF something or other. I wanted to reappropriate the what is used for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth on the framework desktop and turn that into some other PCI device to make it more useful to me. Because the framework desktop mainboard has, I can't remember if it's 2.5 gigabyte or 5 gigabyte Ethernet on board, which is all I need because I can plug that into my router. So having identified that I really like their mainboard but didn't like the case it was in, I then went and looked at all of the other Strixhalo, which is the code name for this chipset, manufacturers out there, and they were all doing it wrong as well. And their main boards were not as good, in my opinion. So I bought myself one of the framework desktop main boards and set to work building a new workstation. And I had a number of reasons why I wanted to do this, not least the catastrophic USB hardware bug that I have on my current workstations, which is why I haven't live streamed for 2.5 years, and also why I sit in this chair and record this podcast with you, because it kept messing up my audio interface partway through recording.
Yes, we are intimately familiar with your USB hardware woes.
Yes, we are.
I do apologize again for all of those failed recordings. But the other reason is that I did used to have a Threadripper, and that used to pump out an astonishing amount of heat. So I downsized to a Ryzen 5950X, but then I ended up with two GPUs in that, and Kelsapries, that also pumps out an awful lot of heat as well. So my recent workstation computers have produced a lot of heat, they use a lot of power, and they make a lot of noise. The last one not being conducive for podcasting, and the first two not being conducive for using during the day when you're working from home.
So is the framework mainboard a standard mainboard form factor that you were able to buy some other case for and mount yourself, or did you have to get something or do something a bit more custom?
No, it was really easy. So the framework desktop mainboard is a mini ITX form factor mainboard with all of the things in the right place that you would expect to find it. Because it's a system on chip, it has a thonking great big heat sink over the SoC, and it comes with a little mounting kit for you to add your own fan. So actually assembling this thing is really easy because you didn't have to seat the processor or plug RAM in or any of that stuff. And you didn't have to mess around with GPUs either because it's all on the one thing. So it was just a simple matter of attaching a fan to the top of the heatsink and sticking it in a case. And the case that I got was a Deepcool CH160, which is about the size of two shoeboxes stacked on top of one another. So this is quite a twee little computer. It's not very big at all. And even in that small amount of space, I was able to add case fans front and back as well. So it's got two case fans. And because it's a chipset that can run in a laptop, this is sort of an overkill amount of cooling for that device. Yeah. So consequently, it does run at sort of ambient temperatures. And from that point of view, I was really happy with it. I did some things that were not in keeping of it being sort of a low power device. So
did you massively overclock it?
Well, no, I haven't had to do that. I'll get to that in a moment. But one of the reasons why it is able to run fast is that I got an 850 watt modular SFX power supply for it. And this was kind of deliberate. I didn't actually need one as big as that.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I did this is because this SoC can sip power when it's just, you know, when you're editing, you know, code or browsing web pages, it draws like, you know, 12 watts of power. So not very much at all. But when you crank up all the cores and you fully load this thing, it can draw between 120 and 140 watts. That's quite a range of power draw. And in the pre-built systems, quite often they have quite small power supplies, like, you know, 240 or 320 watt PSUs. Yeah. And I wanted to let this system stretch its legs. When I would demanded processing power, I wanted it to be able to deliver. And so the slightly over-specced PSU does mean that when I demand the power, all cores clock to 5.1 gigahertz and it delivers. It's brilliant.
And as I've learned recently, if you overspec your PSU, you might thank yourself in the future when you want to suddenly attach four more hard disks to the same device.
Right. And so when it comes to attaching things, I added two SSDs, you know, boot and root, and I'm using ButterFS there with lux and compression and sub volumes to sort of balance some of my, what's in my home directory is actually on the boot 2 terabyte drive, and it uses ButterFS sub volumes to just sort of relocate some large directories from my home directory onto the other drive to make good use of the space available. And then I mentioned the PCI slot. So the reason I wanted to use that is I have HDMI capture cards that my cameras connect to. And I spent quite a lot of money on that about 6 years ago, and I didn't want to lose that. So those HDMI capture cards are only like PCI Gen 2, not even PCI Express.
Oh, okay. So, right.
So they slot into the 4-lane PCI slot just fine. So they're all working off the built-in PCI slot. And then the socket that is typically used for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, I got this funky adapter from Amazon, which I'll have a link to in the show notes because it's got lots of three-letter acronyms in it. But it turns that Wi-Fi socket into a single-lane PCI Express port socket slot.
I've actually seen one of these adapters before. When I was building my new server from my Wise Thin client, one of the other hacks for this is that you take out the Wi-Fi card and you add a second SSD slot using exactly this method.
Right. And this is precisely what I've done. So although this exposes mechanically a single PCI Express slot, I have plugged into that one of my homemade storage slices. So I buy these little adapters from a company in Spain that enable you to put two or four M.2 SATA SSDs on. So I have 2 4-terabyte SSDs on this board, and that plugs into the socket, and that's what I use. So with a bit of RAID striping in Linux, that gives me an 8-terabyte volume, which is my backup target. So all of my backups go to this little board with a couple of SSDs on it. And that's why I didn't want the Wi-Fi chip, because I wanted to maintain my internal snapshot backup mechanism.
So are we going to see you live streaming again in the near future?
It might just happen. I mean, what you will see, hopefully soon, is you'll see me from the other angle again, because I'll be able to move back to my original desk. I did throw in a Thunderbolt 4 hub so I could plug in extra peripherals and ports and things. But yeah, it runs typically at about 12 watts when it's just being used normally. I have managed to make it sweat at 140 watts under full load, and all of the cores boosted to 5.1 gigahertz. So that was pretty great. And what I've noticed is when I come into this room, it runs at ambient room temperature. So I don't notice the temperature in the room rising as I enter the room. And also it's silent. So it will mean when I'm recording the podcast, it won't have that sort of hum and hunting of fans as I'm using it. And then a call back to Alan's segment in the last episode, it can also run large self-hosted LLMs. And so this was another reason for wanting to get one of these, because not only can I do my game development on it, because it's got a fairly decent integrated GPU, but I can allocate up to about 120 gigabytes of that video RAM to run LLMs.
Oh, blimey. That's so a lot of video RAM you've got on there.
Big. Yeah, because it's unified memory in Apple
speak. Okay.
So,
That's very handy.
And it works really well on Linux. That's entirely dynamically allocated. So it allocates 500 meg to the GPU for video output, and it automatically balances and allocates how much RAM it needs for like your typical graphics stuff versus loading LLMs. So I've currently got a split where I reserve, I think I've got it as 48 gigabytes reserved. So that's for system memory, and the rest is for the GPU. Huh.
This motherboard with Ryzen 395 and 128 gigs, this sounds very expensive.
Yes, and the good news is that when I bought this, it was December last year, and I'd been tipped off by my friends I used to work with when we used to build out data centers that the hardware apocalypse was coming, and if you wanted to buy something, you needed to get on and do it quickly. So I actually bought this Christmas last year, but I've been slowly building it over the months since as I've acquired some of the parts I needed. In the intervening period, this thing has almost doubled in price as a result of the memory shortages and all the rest of it. So I was rather fortunate, or a bit of foresight and planning, that I was able to buy it when the prices were still, at least reasonable for what it is.